Well, good evening. Let's go ahead to Daniel chapter 7. Daniel 7, and we will get to Revelation 13, looking at the first part of the chapter. We'll see this this beast from the sea that comes. But we'll start here in Daniel 7, and as we're beginning to look there, curious, how many of you guys have heard of Jesse Owens? Okay, who is Jesse Owens? What is he famous for? The Olympics. Do you remember when? 36. 1936, the midst of Hitler's rise to power, where he's promoting the idea of Aryan supremacy, and Jesse Owens goes to the Olympics in Berlin and wins 4 gold medals. Okay, who's heard of Jackie Robinson? Okay, what's he famous for? Yeah, for playing baseball, breaking the color barrier in baseball, the first of the major sports in the U.S. to do so in 1947. Okay, who has heard of Matthew Robinson? Or he went by Mac Robinson? Ruth has, because I've used this illustration before. Is anybody else? Okay, this is Mac Robinson, as he went by. He was Jackie Robinson's older brother. And he went to Berlin in 1936 as well. He competed in the same Olympics that Jesse Owens did. He and Jesse Owens both competed in the 200-meter race. And when the starting gun goes off, he's actually leading the way. He's leading the pack. Mac Robinson is out in front leading, but he can feel someone coming up close to him. And he does something a runner should never do. Instead of focusing on the finish line, he turns and he takes a glance at Jesse Owens, who is close to him. And as he turns and looks at him, Jesse Owens passes it. And that's one of the 4 gold medals that Jesse Owens won, and Mac Robinson won a silver medal. And that's a picture of him in, I think it was the 80s, 1989, holding his silver medal. But he always thought, if he hadn't turned and looked, he would have won. He got distracted by what was going on around him, and he took his eyes off the finish line. And I thought of that story, that illustration, as I thought about Daniel 7 and Revelation 13, two passages that are very closely intertwined. They give a lot of the same information. They give a lot of the same details. We're actually going to look at both a little bit. But these prophecies here in Daniel 7 and then Revelation 13, they point to very dark and very difficult times. Very difficult time in the midst of the tribulation, but they're not without hope. In both passages, there are some things that point to some hope in the midst of them. And so even in the midst of those difficult times, even in the midst of those dark times, God still calls us to faithfulness. He still calls us to endurance, to keeping on going even when things are difficult. But if we're going to do that, if we're going to endure as God has called us to, if we're going to be faithful as God has called us to, we have to keep the right focus. We have to stay focused on the right things in order to be able to keep going. And so as we'll see in these passages, God calls us to faithful endurance all throughout our lives. So I'll start by looking at Daniel's vision here in Daniel 7. And similar to Daniel 8, in Daniel 7, Daniel has a vision. So he gives the details of what he sees, and then he gives the explanation, where God gives him an explanation, typically through angels, of what it means. He gives that explanation. So look first at his vision, and Daniel had a vision of 4 beasts coming out of the sea. We won't read about the first 3, but just some artist's rendition of what they looked like based off of Daniel's description. There's a lion with eagle's wings. There's a bear with 3 ribs in its mouth that's raised up on one side. That's why one shoulder's higher. And then there's a leopard that has 4 heads and 4 wings. And then there's this 4th beast that Daniel doesn't even compare to another animal. He just calls it a terrible beast, a great dreadful beast, and gives some description of it. And we see that description in verses 7 and 8. Daniel 7, starting verse 7, he says, "After this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a 4th beast, terrifying and dreadful, and exceedingly strong. It had great iron teeth. It devoured and broke in pieces and stamped what was left with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. I considered the horns. Behold, there came up among them another horn, a little one, before which three of the first horns were plucked up by the roots. And behold, in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking great things. So Daniel points to this fourth beast. He gives some of a description of it. And then starting in verse 9, we won't take the time to read it tonight, but we looked at this passage a few weeks ago. Starting in verse 9 down through verse 12, or actually even past that, going down to verse 17, in his vision, he sees the Son of Man come to the Ancient of Days. Even in the Old Testament, a picture of God the Son, Jesus, coming to God the Father and receiving a kingdom. So he says, well, I see these four beasts, and then he sees the Son of Man come to God's throne and receive a kingdom, receive dominion, receive authority. Right? And we've seen that in Revelation 11, which is where we turn back to that part of Daniel 7. Revelation 11, if you remember when the seventh trumpet was blown, the announcement was made. The announcement was made, the kingdoms of the earth are become the kingdom of Christ. The nations rage, the nations try to throw off God's authority, but the kingdoms of the earth become the kingdom of Christ. Daniel sees these four beasts, but Christ will still reign as king. And so Daniel also received an explanation of the vision. If we skip down to verse 17, these four great beasts are four kings who shall rise out of the earth. But the saints of the Most High shall receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, forever and ever. If four beasts are explained as four kings and really four kingdoms that go along with them, there's going to be these four kingdoms that come. They are coming. God said they're coming. But the saints of the Most High will receive the kingdom that lasts forever. And that's a very encouraging promise, because even if the kingdoms are terrible, even if things are very difficult in the midst of them, which we see clearly, that particularly in the fourth kingdom, things are very bad. Things are very difficult and very dark in the midst of that kingdom. Hold on to God's promise of his coming kingdom. These kingdoms are difficult. Bad things will happen, but look forward to Christ's kingdom coming that will last forever. Right? And so Daniel's given this explanation, the basic explanation that the four beasts are four kings, but God's kingdom is coming afterwards. Well, what are those four kingdoms? We might look at it and say, okay, so there's four kingdoms coming. What are those kingdoms? And there's kind of a traditional view throughout much of church history. Many conservative scholars that would look at the Bible as we do and take it literally, take it at face value. The traditional view sees these four kingdoms connected to the four kingdoms of Daniel 2. Do you remember what happened in Daniel chapter 2? Something with Nebuchadnezzar and a dream. What happened? Yeah, he has this vision where there's a statue made of different kinds of metal. Different parts of the statue are made with different metals. And then a stone, not cut with human hands, comes and smashes the statue. And then the stone fills the whole earth. And there, God gives Daniel the interpretation to give to Nebuchadnezzar. He very clearly tells him, those are four kingdoms. Those are four kingdoms of the earth. But then the picture of the rock is Christ coming as the king that puts down the kingdoms of earth and sets up his own kingdom. And so traditionally, many in church history have seen this this vision in Daniel 7, four kingdoms again. They say, well, it's probably the same four kingdoms. And so they would see the lion with eagle's wings as Babylon, which was the head of the statue that was directly said in Daniel chapter 2. The bear with ribs in its mouth would be Media and Persia, comes after Babylon. The leopard with four heads and four wings would be Greece. And there, if that interpretation is accurate, the idea of the four heads, the four wings, probably Alexander's empire being split into four kingdoms, like we'd seen last week. And then the terrible beast would be Rome, because that's the fourth kingdom in Daniel 2, the Roman Empire coming after the Greek Empire. And that's a traditional view. You'll hear a lot of conservative scholars say that. And so based on that, when they come to Daniel 7 and they see this fourth kingdom, it's pretty clear from the passage that the fourth kingdom is in power during the tribulation. And we'll get to that. We'll see it in Revelation 13 as well. That fourth kingdom is in power during the tribulation. So say, well, perhaps it's some revival of Rome. Someone brings up the Roman Empire, it comes back to power in the end times. That's possible. Some, especially more modern scholarship that is still conservative, but just a newer idea says, no, it's probably just four more modern kingdoms ending in the tribulation. Both agree on that. But whether it's those four kingdoms or not, it is pretty clear that that the fourth kingdom is in the time of tribulation. And if, as you read about Daniel, read about Revelation, if you hear of a revived Roman Empire, this is where that idea comes from. If people say that, if they say, oh, the Roman Empire is going to come back in the end times, this is where they're drawing that idea from. And so Daniel receives that explanation. But then Daniel's curiosity, focused on the fourth beast, so it receives the longest explanation. That fourth beast, that terrible beast, he's most curious about that, so it receives a longer explanation. He's told in verses 17 and 18, well, the four beasts are four kingdoms, but God's kingdom is coming. Then starting in verse 19, Daniel recounts more of what he saw with this fourth beast. Okay, so he gave some of the explanation, then he comes back to the fourth beast and says, well, it looked like this, and then it's explained. So if we look at verses 19 to 22, it says, then I desired to know the truth about the fourth beast, which was different from all the rest, exceedingly terrifying, with its teeth of iron and claws of bronze, and which devoured in broken pieces and stamped what was left with its feet, and about the 10 horns that were on its head. And saying, I'm curious about these things. And the other horn that came up, and before which three of them fell. And he really focuses on this other horn that comes up, the horn that had eyes and a mouth that spoke great things and that seemed greater than its companions. As I looked, this horn made war with the saints and prevailed over them until the Ancient of Days came and judgment was given for the saints of the Most High, and the time came when the saints possessed the kingdom. That verse 21, he says, this horn made war with the saints and prevailed over them. Where else do we see that idea? Where else do we see that wording? Do you remember? We get to it in a little bit. It's in Revelation 13. We mentioned it very briefly a couple weeks ago. But Revelation 13:7 uses almost that same wording. Speaking of the Antichrist, saying he makes war with the saints. And in Revelation, it says he overcame them. He was a conqueror of them. Things are going to be very difficult during that kingdom. It is a kingdom. The horn is a ruler. We'll see the horn points to the Antichrist. He makes war with the saints. He's prevailing over them. He is conquering them. He is being successful physically during that time of the tribulation. But here, what stops the war on the saints and gives them the victory? Specifically in verse 22, who comes and puts an end to the war? The Ancient of Days. This war is going on until God steps in and God brings the victory. And then those same saints who were being conquered, who were being prevailed over, they possess the kingdom. And that's a couple of time markers. They're putting this, that's why I say the fourth kingdom is during the time of the tribulation. Revelation 13 says that war on the saints, the prevailing over them, puts in the time of tribulation. But also it puts Christ's return, God stepping in and setting up his kingdom, which we know is at the end of the tribulation, it puts it here against this fourth kingdom. And so it's kind of a time marker pointing to the time of the tribulation. But it's interesting. Daniel specifies God's the one that steps in. The Ancient of Days comes. God's the one that steps in and gives the victory. And so Daniel explains what he's been seeing, and then he received an explanation of that fourth beast. What is this beast? What is going to go on? Starting verse 23, thus he said, the one who's explaining to Daniel says to Daniel, as for the fourth beast, there shall be a fourth kingdom on earth. So that's the idea. It's a kingdom that's on earth, which shall be different from all the kingdoms, and it shall devour the whole earth and trample it down and break it to pieces. Something that throughout history many have tried to do, set up a kingdom that rules over the whole earth. Daniel's told this kingdom that comes, this fourth beast, the fourth kingdom, will devour the whole earth. It will rule over the whole earth. And as for the 10 horns, out of this kingdom, 10 kings shall arise, and another shall arise after them. Okay, so it's put it in the time of the tribulation. It says there's a kingdom over the whole earth. And it says 10 kings. Those 10 horns represent 10 kings that will be in that kingdom. And again, that's why if you read about Revelation, if you read about Daniel, time of the tribulation, a lot of times we'll hear of a 10 kings, or maybe the earth being divided into 10 regions that each has a king over it. Whether it's that or whether it's 10 nations like Media and Persia united to defeat Babylon, maybe it's 10 nations that unite to try to conquer the world. Either way, it points to these 10 kings being in power. Okay? That, again, that's where that idea comes from. If we read of the earth being divided amongst 10 kings, something like that, it's coming from this prophecy here in Daniel 7. And so there's 10 kings who are in power. The kingdom's in place. The 10 kings are in power. But that other horn comes up. That other horn being another king, he shall be different from the former ones. He's not one of the 10. And he shall put down 3 kings. Okay, he comes to power in some way. Again, this is the prophecy. What exactly it looks like won't be clear until it happens. But he puts down 3 of those kings. In his rise to power, he shall speak words against the Most High. He'll speak against God. He'll blaspheme God. He shall wear out the saints of the Most High and shall think to change the times and the law. He'll wear out the saints. He'll make war on them. He'll think to try to change the times and law. They shall be given into his hand for a time, times, and half a time. There's that time frame again, that 3.5 years. But the court shall sit in judgment, and his dominion shall be taken away. He's going to have this powerful kingdom, but eventually it's going to be taken away. He's got 3.5 years, and then his dominion is gone to be consumed and destroyed to the end. And the kingdom and the dominion and the greatness of the kingdoms, under the whole heaven shall be given to the people of the saints of the Most High. His kingdom shall be an everlasting kingdom, and all dominion shall serve and obey him. The kingdom's taken away from this one, and the saints receive the kingdom. It's explained, it's said again and emphasized, the saints receive the kingdom. The Antichrist comes to power for a time, but eventually he's put down, and God's kingdom will come. Okay, so let's summarize it. We were going to look at that pretty quickly. Kind of took a few minutes longer than I wanted. But summing up Daniel 7, we could go into a lot more details. There's a lot of things we skimmed over. We tried to see a quick overview. If you have questions, let me know. We can talk about it afterwards, talk about it another time. There's a lot more we could dig into. But if we sum it up, the main gist of Daniel's vision with that fourth beast, there's one kingdom over the whole earth with 10 kings. But then 3 of those kings are put down by the Antichrist. And the Antichrist, as he comes to power, he rises to power. He makes war on the saints. He blasphemes God. But he's defeated in the end. And in the end, the saints inherit God's kingdom. God's kingdom is victorious. All right, so let's go over to Revelation 12. That's Daniel's vision, a quick overview of it. Revelation 12. I did put one verse in there. Revelation 12. Before we get into chapter 13, John has a very similar vision to what Daniel had. Revelation 13, John has a similar vision of beasts that represents specific things. But as we come to chapter 13, don't let that big number 13 mess you up. Ruth gave me for Christmas a reader's Bible that puts the Bible in paragraphs but leaves out the chapters and verses. And it's good to read through. It helps you see the flow of how things go together, because here, chapter 12 and chapter 13 go together. It's not separate things. It's not separate ideas. We have chapter 13 because of the end of chapter 12. The end of chapter 12 in verse 17, remember, dragon being cast out of heaven, Satan's cast out of heaven. He tries to pursue the woman. The woman's protecting the wilderness. And then verse 17, then the dragon became furious with the woman and went off to make war on the rest of her offspring, on those who keep the commandments of God and hold to the testimony of Jesus. And he stood on the sand of the sea. And then the beast comes up out of the sea. Okay, it said Satan went and made war on the other offspring of the women, He goes and makes war on the other ones who believe in God, who keep the commandments of God, hold to their testimony of Christ. Well, what does that war look like? How does he do it? What is Satan actually doing to make war on the saints? Well, that's what chapter 13 tells us. Chapter 13 is going to expand on that and say, well, he raises this one up that we often call the Antichrist. And then he raises up the one that we often call the false prophet. And they are the ones that Satan uses to make war on the saints. So chapter 13 is really explaining how Revelation 12, 17 actually happens. Okay, and just kind of a side note, we often call him the Antichrist. He's actually only given that title once in Scripture. 1 John 2:18, he's directly called the Antichrist, one who sets himself up against Christ, but he is called by other names. Daniel 7, he's that horn that comes up. Revelation 13, he's the beast, a beast coming out of the sea. 2 Thessalonians 2, he's the man of sin, man of lawlessness. Given different titles, but we typically call him the Antichrist. And so if we look at what it says about him, his description, verses 1 and 2, says, "And I saw a beast rising out of the sea with 10 horns," sounds like Daniel 7, that beast had 10 horns as well, "and 7 heads with 10 diadems on its horns." Daniel 7, the horns were 10 kings. Diadem is a kingly crown. It's not a crown of victory, it's a kingly crown. There's 10 diadems on the 10 horns. That part probably is a picture of those same 10 kings. "And blasphemous names on its heads. And the beast that I saw was like a leopard. Its feet were like a bear's. Its mouth was like a lion's mouth." Hey, where have we just seen those three animals? They were the other three animals, the other three kingdoms in Daniel chapter 7. "And to it, the dragon gave his power and his throne and great authority." Okay, so here the Antichrist, and kind of using it interchangeably, the term beast, again, kind of interchangeably between the king and the kingdom, the government and the ruler of the government. It's how Daniel's visions are. That's how we often explain things. We'll talk about Nazi Germany doing this. We'll talk about Hitler doing this. We use them somewhat interchangeably for what they did then, and for their Nazi guards that I didn't know Pastor Jeremy was one of. But we speak of the things that the Nazi guards do on behalf of their country. But here in chapter 13, it's kind of using it interchangeably. At times, the beast, the description of the beast or what's said points to the kingdom, the government. At times, it points to the Antichrist as the head of that government. Okay? But it's describing it much like the beast in Daniel 7, but also actually much like the dragon. If you remember in chapter 12, where that dragon first appeared, he was described as having 10 horns and 7 heads, just like this beast, except there he had 7 crowns, here 10 crowns, probably because of those 10 kings that we saw in Daniel 7. But this beast is described very much like Satan. He is very clearly closely connected to Satan. He is following Satan. He's serving Satan and what Satan's trying to accomplish. And the beast apparently has a deadly wound that is healed. Verse 3 says, "One of its heads seemed to have a mortal wound, but its mortal wound was healed, and the whole earth marveled as they followed the beast." Okay, and again, there's a lot of speculation about how this actually happens, what it looks like, but here it says one of the heads of the beast. Later on, it refers to the beast as a whole. Later on in the chapter, it speaks of this beast having a deadly wound that is healed. And people go back and forth on it. Some say, well, it's the appearance of death. It's a deception. He seems like he dies, or they intentionally create some deception to say he's died, and then he's healed. Others say, well, perhaps he does really die, and in this case, God permits him to be raised from the dead. Okay, both those ideas are suggested. The ones that say, well, no, it's just the appearance of death, it's deception. Sometimes I'll point to verse 3 where it says he seemed to have a mortal wound and say, see, he seems to have it. He didn't really have it. That's saying he didn't really die. Okay? It's very possible he didn't die. Personally, I don't think that he does. But just to clarify what Scripture says, we actually can't point to that little phrase, he seemed to have, to say he didn't die. Because if you think back to chapter 5, there's a scene in heaven. Remember, John sees that scroll, and the call is given, is anyone worthy to open the scroll? And John's weeping because no one's found worthy. And then the angel tells him, don't weep. There's a lion who can open it. And what does John turn and see? He's told he'll see that there's a lion there. What does he see? He sees a lamb. How is the lamb described? Do you remember? What? As was slain. It says he's standing as though slain. And that little, it says as though slain, at least in the ESV. Here it says he seemed to have. It's the same Greek phrase, though. It's the same Greek phrase in both passages. And obviously, we certainly wouldn't say, well, Christ only had the appearance of death. He obviously did genuinely die. So some would say, well, even with this wording, it is possible that the Antichrist genuinely dies. Satan's obviously trying to make a counterfeit, make an imitation of Christ. And so from the wording, it could be either way, whether he does genuinely die or whether it is just a deception. Like I said, personally, I still lean towards it being deception. I don't know that God would permit Satan to have that power to raise from the dead. Okay, but what is the main point? What is the main point? What is the main result of this going on? In response to the healing, the people of the earth worship the beast and Satan. However, the wound is actually healed. The main point is that the people of the earth believe he's raised from the dead, and so they worship him. Whether he was actually all the way dead or whether he's mostly dead and still a little bit alive, but healed from that, the people of the earth believe he was raised. Those that don't follow Christ, just the earth dwellers, those that have rejected Christ, they believe that this one, this Antichrist, is raised. And so what do? Verse 4, they worship the dragon, for he had given his authority to the beast. They worship Satan himself. Satan has wanted to be like the Most High. Satan's wanting to take the place of God. Satan's wanted to receive worship, and he receives worship here. They worship the dragon, and they worship the beast, saying, who is like the beast, and who can fight against it? They worship the beast as well. They worship the Antichrist. The people of the earth willingly do so. Okay? That phrase, who is like the beast, can you think of another place in Scripture, there's actually several, that a similar phrase is used in connection of worship? It's not saying who is like the beast, but what phrase is often used? I think somebody said, but I didn't hear what they said. Yeah, who is like God? Who is like the Lord? Rhetorical question often asked in the Old Testament to say, who is like the Lord? The answer is no one. No one is like the Lord. He is the one who truly deserves worship. Here, again, Satan making a counterfeit, making one that appears to rise from the dead, making one that appears to be a king, making one who sets himself up like God to be worshipped, trying to set up a counterfeit in place of what God has. And so the people of the earth worship him in response to that healing. They willingly do so, but it is something the Antichrist seeks as well. Last week we looked at Antiochus IV. On 167 BC, he went into the Jewish temple. He set up that altar to Zeus. He offered a pig on it, desecrating the temple, and he demanded worship of himself. He took that name Epiphanes. He claimed to be a manifestation of the gods. He claimed that he was a god. Very similar way, the Antichrist does something much like that. 2 Thessalonians 2, verses 3 and 4. Let no one deceive you in any way, for that day will not come unless the rebellion comes first and the man of lawlessness is revealed. There's that title, man of lawlessness, sometimes translated man of sin, the son of destruction, who opposes and exalts himself against every so-called god or object of worship, so that he takes his seat in the temple of God, proclaiming himself to be God. Okay, the man of lawlessness, the man of sin, we commonly call him the Antichrist. What's he do? He sets himself up in the temple of God, proclaims himself to be God, much like Antiochus IV had done. If you remember back to the beginning of Revelation 11, where he looked at the two witnesses, there's also a temple. There's a temple in Jerusalem that there are Jews worshiping, trying to worship God, but not believing in Christ. They're offering sacrifices. At some point, this Antichrist goes to that temple. He sets himself up as God. He takes a seat in the temple of God, proclaiming himself to be God. And if we think about Daniel 9, if we think about Matthew 24, apparently that most likely happens at the midpoint of the tribulation. Because remember, Daniel 9, the Antichrist had made a peace treaty for 7 years. Halfway through, he breaks it. Halfway through, he cuts off the sacrifices. Halfway through, Daniel calls it the abomination of desolation. And Christ in Matthew 24 said, when this happens, those in Judea flee to the mountains, flee out of Israel. Well, we're also told he sets himself up in the temple, proclaiming himself to be God. Reasonably, it doesn't come out and directly tell us. Reasonably, we would assume that's at the same time. Why would he cut off the sacrifices? Why would he tell the Jews, don't offer any more sacrifices? He very reasonably could be claiming to be their Messiah that's come, saying, look at me, worship me. I've risen. You need to worship me, proclaiming himself to be God. Whether it's exactly then or whenever this happens, 2 Thessalonians 2 says he will demand that worship. He will call on people to worship him. So he demands worship. The beast also rebels against God. He blasphemes God. Verses 5 and 6. Beast was given a mouth uttering haughty and blasphemous words. Something we were told in Daniel that he does as well. It was allowed to exercise authority for 42 months. It opened its mouth to utter blasphemies against God, blaspheming his name and his dwelling, that is, those who dwell in heaven. Somewhat ironic, we see it today, and the Antichrist is going to do as well, but we see it today where people spend an awful lot of time and an awful lot of energy criticizing and opposing and fighting something they claim not to believe in. People who reject Christ, people who say God doesn't exist, that they would deny the existence of God, they spend an awful lot of time and energy speaking against him. That's what the Antichrist is going to do as well. He's going to say, don't worship any other gods, worship me. But he spends much time and energy blaspheming God and speaking against God as well. So he blasphemes God. He also makes war on the saints. Again, we see that in verse 17. He pursued the woman, or chapter 12, verse 17, pursues the woman's offspring. Daniel 7, 21, 25, we already looked at them. But the Antichrist makes war. He prevails over the saints. Well, here in Revelation 13, beginning of verse 7, also it was allowed to make war on the saints and to conquer them. He blasphemes God, he speaks against God, and he also attacks those who believe in God. And then one last thing, he attempts to set up his kingdom on earth, a kingdom that's empowered by Satan. We'd already read the end of verse 2, but and to it, to the beast, the dragon, Satan himself gives his power and his throne and great authority. The end of verse 7, after he makes war on the saints, it says, and authority was given it over every tribe and people and language and nation. Over the whole earth, authority is given to this beast. Just like in Daniel 7, the beast was going to devour the whole earth. The Antichrist here has a kingdom, a government, that rules over the whole earth. If you think about Christ's temptation. When Satan came and tempted Christ, and Satan shows him all the kingdoms of the world, what does Satan offer? He says, I'll give you these kingdoms if you bow down and worship me. Again, Satan wanting worship. Obviously, Christ denies that, rejects the temptation. Christ rightfully will rule as king. He doesn't need to worship Satan. He is the rightful king anyway. But do you think that's the only time Satan ever made that offer? Do you think Christ is the only one that Satan ever said, if you bow down and worship me, I'll give you the kingdoms of the earth? Apparently, this Antichrist, that's what he's doing. He's given himself over to Satan. He's committed to Satan. He, as we see, points people to follow Satan, to reject Christ, and he is given the kingdoms of the earth. And so, like Antiochus, the Antichrist's power is not his own. Remember last week we said Antiochus, he came to power. He wasn't supposed to be king. His nephew was. He lies, he bribes, he deceives people into becoming king. Here the Antichrist doesn't set himself up. Satan gives him the authority. Satan gives him the power. Well, why is it significant about this kingdom? Mentioned it already, but thinking all the way back to chapter 11, verse 15, the seventh trumpet is blown. When that seventh trumpet is blown, what's the announcement? Revelation 11, 15, then the seventh angel blew his trumpet. There were loud voices in heaven saying, the kingdom of the world has become the kingdom of our Lord and of his Christ, and he shall reign forever and ever. There, the announcement's made, kingdoms of the world have become the kingdom of Christ. Christ will rule. As Daniel 7 says, the saints do inherit the kingdom. But then there in chapter 11, verse 18, and it references Psalm 2, the nations rage against God's kingdom. They try to rage But then God's wrath comes, and God's kingdom is set up. Why do we have Revelation 12 and Revelation 13? Why, thinking big picture of the whole book, why are they in here? Well, it's because of that seventh trumpet. The announcement was made, the kingdoms of the earth become the kingdom of Christ. Well, what do the kingdoms of earth look like? They're trying to rage against God. They're trying to shake their fist at God, reject his authority. What does that look like? Well, chapter 12, chapter 13 tells us. It's Satan trying to set up his kingdom, trying to set up his counterfeit, raising up this government, raising up this false prophet with a false religion, but they will be defeated. They will lose in the end. And that's one of the things, the encouraging things that's emphasized. The Antichrist is limited in the time he will reign. Saw last week in Daniel 8, the terror of Antiochus IV was limited to 2,300 days. The prophecy had said that up front. It'll be 2,300 days, and then the temple will be cleansed. Here in verse 5, the end of verse 5, it was allowed to exercise authority. It's been given the authority. It can exercise that authority for 42 months. Daniel 7 had given that same time as time, times, half time, 3.5 years, but he's limited. Okay? God, in his sovereignty, allows him to have that authority for a certain length of time, but it's limited in time. And for both those that lived under Antiochus and those that are alive during this time of tribulation, that's a very encouraging thing. They live in very difficult times. They live in very dark times. They face much opposition as they try to be faithful to God. But they can be reminded, okay, I'm seeing this now. I'm seeing this one that the Bible calls the Antichrist. He's making war against us that still follow Christ. He's demanding worship. He's not going to last. It seems like he's beating us now. He's not going to last. He only has 42 months. And see, Antichrist is limited in his time. And then one other comment before we conclude. I'm just kind of trying to fit big picture of the tribulation together. Daniel 9:27 put the Antichrist on the scene at the beginning of the tribulation. He's the one that makes that peace treaty with Israel, the same one who cuts it off, who cuts off the sacrifices, who demands worship. He's on the scene at the beginning of the tribulation, but he only has this great power during the last half of the tribulation. He is already a world figure who is present, who is obvious, who is on the scene, but he doesn't have that great power for the whole tribulation. He has it for the last half of the tribulation. And then his kingdom is cut off. So we see two visions that point to very difficult times, kind of the big picture of the last half of the tribulation, very difficult times. But the application of the passage applies to us. Even if we don't live in those times, the application given here does apply to us. The end of verse 10. Here is a call for the endurance and the faith of the saints. Here's all the difficulties that are coming. Here's what this Antichrist looks like. Here's what he's going to do. Here's how he's going to make things hard. Well, here's a call for the endurance and the faith of the saints. I have a picture there I ran cross country in college. I wasn't as fast as Jesse Owens. Probably should clarify that. One time I was preaching somewhere else, and I went to use the illustration, and I said in passing, you know, when I was training for a relay race for the Olympics, and then I went on with my illustration, I got a couple funny looks, and I realized, probably should clarify, it was the Iwana Olympics. It wasn't the Summer Olympics. But I did run the Iwana Olympics. I did run cross-country in college. And for me, and for a lot of people who run, we would run five-mile races. The hardest mile was always the third mile. Out of five, the third was always the hardest. Why? Well, this race in particular, it was our nationals race. If you can see a lot of water on the ground, it was in Ohio. It had rained for 2 days. Like, solidly, all through the day, for the 2 days before we ran, that there was probably 2-3 inches of mud before you could get down to dry ground, and then there were puddles sitting on top. And so what was it like to run? We ran a lot of miles. You get tired as you're going, obviously, and there's always something that's sore, that hurts. You might not feel it at the beginning of the race, but by about the third mile, you're definitely going to feel everything that hurts. You're, in this one, you're bogged down by the mud. It's you have the illustration of Hebrews 12. Those things are weighing you down as you try to run. I have pictures afterwards. I had like mud splattered all the way up my back. But running in that mud was hard. Things hurt. Things are sore. And in the third mile in particular, you can't see the finish line. You can't see the end yet. the beginning, the first mile, the first, second mile, you're not quite as tired. Things aren't quite as sore yet. Fourth mile, you're getting close. The fifth mile, you're looking ahead. Man, I'm almost there. I'm almost through this difficult race. The third mile, right when you're in the midst of the difficulty and when you feel like you can't see the end, that's the most difficult time. And that's the time that it's easy for us to look at our circumstances, to look at the soreness, to look at the tiredness, to look at the mud, and take our eyes off the finish line. Take our eyes off of the goals that we should have. But God says, here's 3.5 years of very dark days in history. But there is a hope. At the end, this terrible ruler will be put down. The saints who right now seem to be being defeated, they will reign in that kingdom. They will possess the kingdom. And it's not a kingdom that lasts for 3.5 years or 7 years. It's a kingdom that lasts forever. Daniel emphasizes that part. It lasts forever, forever and ever. It's going to last forever, and they'll be part of that kingdom. So in the midst of the difficulty, in the midst of the hard time, yes, sometimes it looks like you can't see the finish line. It looks like you can't see the end. Things are hard. Things are difficult. But God says, keep enduring. Keep illustration of running. Keep putting one foot in front of the other. Keep running. Keep enduring. Keep being faithful. And another verse that, for me, has been a very encouraging verse with this idea is 2 Corinthians. 2 Corinthians 4:1. Therefore, having this ministry by the mercy of God, we do not lose heart. King James says we do not faint. The idea is we don't quit, we don't faint, we don't lose heart. God's given us a ministry, whether for Paul, it's some of us, it's a full-time ministry, or if it's we work a secular job and we have other ways of serving God, God gives us the chance to serve. God gives us the chance to minister for him. And he's given us his mercy. His mercy that we see most clearly in salvation, but even in God giving us salvation and then being merciful enough to give us a ministry, an opportunity to serve him. God gives us his mercy. God gives us a ministry, an opportunity to serve him. Well, those are good things. So don't lose heart. Don't quit. Don't faint. Don't walk away. Yes, things get difficult. Sometimes we can't see the end, but we do know what happens in the end. We do know in the end, God is victorious. That's why you're going to sing, there is a higher throne. There is a higher throne than the world has known. A throne that will rule over everything. A throne that will rule forever. So we can't, in the midst of the difficulty, sometimes we can't see our way out of it. We don't see what the end is. We don't see how it could end well. But in the big picture, God promises us that it will. And so God calls us to faithful endurance all throughout our lives. We need to keep enduring. We need to be faithful each step of the way. So I'll stop there for tonight. Next week we'll plan to look at the last part of chapter 13. We'll see the beast from the earth. But any questions, any comments?